Hello and welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change, where we explore the ideas that are forming our future reality. My name is Dr. Rosalind Savage. After an environmental epiphany 20 years ago, I left a corporate career to row solo across three oceans, using my adventures to raise environmental awareness. And ever since then, I've been obsessed with how we create a better world. On this show, I talk with scientists, philosophers, economists, and activists about how we create a thriving world for people and planet.
But I'd like to sort of expand that, to go beyond unity and diversity, to go even beyond unity in inclusion, to unity in belonging. To remember that we belong here. We belong to each other. We belong to our planetary home. We belong to our entire universe. We are loved. We are supported. And if we can wake up to that knowingness, we literally can change the world and heal ourselves and heal our relationship with the whole world.
My guest today is the wonderful Dr. Jude Currivan, who I've known for several years now through her work with the Whole World View community. It's hard to categorise Jude, as she combines and transcends many diverse worlds. She's a mystic, a successful international businesswoman. She has a master's degree in physics from Oxford, specialising in cosmology and quantum physics. She also has a PhD in archaeology from the University of Reading. But above all, I would say she is a powerful agent for conscious change and evolution, as well as being one of the warmest, most delightful and delight-filled human beings that I know. She and her husband Tony live near Avebury. If you don't know Avebury, it's famous as the site of the largest stone circle in the world, which is about 5,000 years old, and it's one of the most significant pagan sites in the UK. In our conversation, we touch on divinity and humanity, science and spirituality, mysticism, complexity theory, intuition, coalitions of the willing, the Celestine prophecy, Gaia, internet bullying, Buddha babies, the year 2067, the Big Bang, although Jude contends that it wasn't big and it wasn't a bang, forest bathing, kohlrabi, and brassica massacres, and quite literally the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. Jude, I want to say thank you so much for being here. It's absolutely lovely to see you again, and thank you so much for agreeing to be on Sowing the Seeds of Change. This is a real pleasure.
I'm delighted to be. I really am, and it really is sowing the seeds of change, isn't it? This is what this time's about. So thank you for inviting me.
So I like to kick off these conversations by asking you for your favourite quote. So if you have yours handy in front of you, would you be able to share that with us, please?
Be delighted to. It's a quote that's very simple, but it's meant a lot to me over the years. In the commonality of our humanity, we're all ordinary. In the commonality of our divinity, we're all extraordinary.
That's so beautiful. And I love the uniqueness of this quote, because obviously we often have people quoting from a book or from a speech or something like that. But this quote actually came to you through a completely different medium, didn't it? Could you please share the story of where this quote came from?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. It was when I was researching for my PhD in archaeology. And one of the things I was doing was what's called field walking, where you walk over a particular area of land and you're looking for artifacts, in this case, Stone Age flints. And I'd arrived at a field near Avebury, which is near where I live in Wiltshire, England. And it was this gorgeous summer day, bright blue sky. And I was there on my own before everyone else arrived. And as I was just really taking in the beauty of that moment, literally a nameless voice came out of the blue sky with this quote. And it really just, I received it in my heart and I received it in my soul. And it's been with me ever since, to the extent that I use it on the strapline of my personal website, because it speaks to me of our ordinariness and our extraordinariness, of our divinity and our humanity. And in that place where 5,000 years ago, our ancestors were making flints and living their ordinary, extraordinary lives, it really touched my heart.
It's such a beautiful reminder, because we too often forget, or in many cases, never knew how extraordinary and how divine we are. And that feels like such an important message for our times. And I wonder if you can say a bit more about what this divine extraordinariness means to you personally.
For me, and you may know this, Roz, I began to hear voices when I was very young. I was about 4 years old. And that sort of age, there was no supernaturalness about it. It was just, okay, you know, another voice telling me what to do or not what to do. But I was beginning to hear voices. I was also beginning to be aware of being able to see things that were beyond what I suspect most people were, even though I didn't have any conversations about that. But from that time, and ever since, the whole of my life, I've both been a very ordinary human being, as we all are, but I've walked between worlds and I've experienced reality and realities in much more, perhaps multidimensional, more unified ways that the spiritual seekers of all ages have told us that is the truer, deeper nature of reality. So whatever words we want to speak of it as, it really has enabled me to experience something greater than this little me, but a realization that this is what we all are and this is what the whole world is. So when we talk of divine, it's that spiritual aspect of us that's innate to us, that flows through us and is always there because it's innately part of us. So for me, I've chosen to welcome it as an integral part of my life journey.
And we'll be coming back to that throughout this conversation. But first of all, I'm just picturing 4-year-old Jude going to her parents and talking about this voice that she's heard. Did you talk to your parents about it? And how did they respond? Because I would imagine that a lot of children have some direct experience of this magic, but it kind of gets squished out of them because their parents tell them maybe, oh, you know, don't be silly, that's impossible. Or they put it down to being an imaginary friend. So did you share this? How did you manage to hold on to this beautiful discovery, this aspect of your life?
I didn't share it. And it's not that I was fearful of sharing it. It just never occurred to me to share it. For many years, it never occurred to me. I was enjoying it. I was having fun. The experiences I were having were just really just opening my sense of possibilities and potential and experiences and levels of existence and levels of intelligence and sentience way beyond this physical realm. So it never occurred to me to share it with any of my human family or friends or companions. And I guess in hindsight, that I was very fortunate because it never got squished out of me. And when I became an adult and eventually started to share it, it was more in response to other people saying and sharing their experiences. And when I began to share mine, not to try and impose on anybody, not to try and persuade anybody, but just circumstances sort of kept arising, you know, where it was appropriate, it felt appropriate just to share. And so many times people have said, I can share my stories now with you. And what I realized in speaking with many, many people is, as you say, so often children do have these experiences, and not just their parents, but society generally, because, you know, we live in a society of materialism and separation. And those experiences, whilst many, many people have them and they're natural to us, are just denigrated or peripheralized or told they're imaginary or they're not important. So for many, many people, yeah, they get squished out early. I was very fortunate they didn't. And what I'm finding now is that people are waking up to realize in their own lives and their own experiences and how enriching these sort of communications and adventures can be.
I'm wondering, I'm reflecting on a conversation that I had with a very dear friend of mine who lives in San Francisco. And she was saying how quite a number of her friends are having babies at the moment. And her perception is that there is something different about these babies. And she's talking about a small sample, but 7 or 8, you know, it's not just 1 or 2, that they seem to be almost like little Buddhas. You know, they seem to arrive into this world with a very special quality, kind of prepackaged. And I'm wondering if you were sort of on the bell curve, if you were at the avant-garde of this rising wave of, what can I call it, like multidimensional beings incarnating on this planet at this particular time. Have you been, what's the word on the street about these special babies?
Well, the word on the street is exactly that. I mean, you know, I've just written my forthcoming book called Gaia, Her Story. And, you know, I'm carrying on this emergent new science, which is radically different from the old science of materialism and separation. This radical new view of reality, of multidimensionality, ultimately a unified cosmos, a cosmos where mind and consciousness aren't something we have, but literally what we and the whole world are. And an evolutionary cosmology, a universe that doesn't just exist and evolve in this profoundly interconnected and unified way, but has this impulse to evolve from simplicity to complexity. So what I'm finding, and the word on the street, is that we're going through a process of conscious evolution. So those of us who were born, you know, I'm nearly 70 years old, so I still, when I was born, was still coming into a world where pioneers had really been beginning to bring through this emergent perspective. Spiritual seekers for millennia already had, but it was starting to come through sort of what I call pioneers, secular pioneers of consciousness. I experienced it, others of my generation did, and more, and certainly since the 1970s, there's been these waves and waves of more and more awakening, and not just with the new babies coming, but I'd say Generation X, Generation Z, you know, the previous generations have all come in and embodied an evolutionary consciousness. So the babies now that are being born, they're gorgeous, they're little Buddhas. They are. So it just feels this wave of collective conscious evolution, and they are a wonderful part of it.
And also, and I'd really like to say this for the listeners, my perception is that you don't have to be born that way. People can wake up at any age. You don't have to arrive already on that wavelength. That it's possible for anybody at any age with any kind of background of cultural conditioning to wake up to this new way of being that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And I think what's wonderful is our technologies. And I realise that science, in many ways, the old science, which has hung on to this, not just outworn and unsustainable, but fundamentally wrong perspective of materialism and separateness, nonetheless has developed technologies that have allowed us to see further into the universe than ever before, smaller, larger scales, but it's also come forward with technologies that enable us to have this conversation, that enable us as a human family to see each other in ways that we've never been able to before. And of course, like any technology, it of itself is neutral. It's how we utilize it or how it uses us for good or ill. But, you know, we are able to do that. So we have access to all the cultures, all of the traditions, all of the paths, you know, of all faiths and none, into an exploration and an experience and opportunities to wake up.
And we'll definitely come back to that intersection of science and spirituality because, you know, that is your wheelhouse, as our American friends would say. Just before that, I would love to know whether you feel it's any coincidence that this awakening process is going on at the exact same time when some of our global crises seem to be bigger than ever. And I'm not really talking about the pandemic here. I'm really thinking about our ecological crisis. on the one, it feels like there's this real intensification that we have unprecedented challenges, but we also have unprecedented cosmic superpowers, for lack of a better phrase, in order to face those challenges. So is there some sort of a connection in the timing here?
Yes, in my perspective, yes, there is. And certainly in my experience and worldview, I don't believe in accidents and coincidences as such. You know, I feel that what we see on the sort of the surface of what we call reality is like the froth on the surface of a much deeper ocean. And as an ocean rower, you know all about waves on the surface and froth, and you know about the depth of the ocean.
Just a little bit, yes.
Just a little bit, probably more than anyone else, you know, in the world. So really what I would agree with is there are undercurrents, there are tidal currents that are very much under the surface, but they're coming to the surface. And so, yes, I feel that the, you know, we've had a worldview. Our worldview drives our behaviours. You know, it shapes how we see the world. It definitely shapes the decisions we make in the world. And collectively, we've had a worldview, as I say, that's really been based on the old science. And it's the old 19th century science. It's not even 20th century science. It's 19th century science of materialism and separation. And sure enough, when we look out, our world does appear to be made up of separate things. And so we've sort of behaved accordingly, whether that's the way our governance, our education, our organisations, our healthcare, those structures are really 19th century structural forms founded on a 19th century science. So that's driven how we behave with each other. It's driven the way we behave with our planetary home. And it's totally unsustainable, as we know. So we've come to the end of the road of any way in which we can have that worldview be other than destructive. And so what happens in evolutionary biology is that when a system becomes unsustainable, whether it's an ecosystem or a weather pattern or whatever, it literally begins to break down. And yet, in terms of evolution, at the same time that it's breaking down, a new level of potential emergence, a higher level of complexity begins to possibly potentize. And so the breakdown in evolutionary biology is often accompanied by a potential breakthrough. And I think that's what's happening. And what we find in evolutionary biology is something called flickering. And when something flickers, it's when that old system can no longer sustain. But as it breaks down, it's sort of creating a bridge to this newer possibility. So it jumps forward and it jumps back. It sort of flickers between the two states. And depending on the level of potentiality and coherence of the emergent system, it can prevail and evolutionary progress continues. And I think that's where we're at. We're flickering between the old breaking down unsustainable and the possibility, the potentiality of our conscious evolution.
That very much resonates with my lived experience of this time, that I have days when I feel really excited and optimistic and it feels like the whole world is waking up. And then there are other days, maybe when I've inadvertently exposed myself to some news headlines, when I'm, should we say, and trying to use polite language here, when I'm less optimistic about the way of the world. It does feel like this sort of flip-flopping as things destabilize. And to really mix my metaphors here, it sort of feels like a two-horse race of like this real shift in consciousness happening, but then also sometimes this rearguard action by the old paradigm. And, you know, which horse is going to win this race?
And I don't know the answer, but I guess we're having this conversation today because both of us have got our own lifetime bet on the conscious evolution horse winning the race.
Absolutely.
But even if it doesn't, we're going to give it our best go at it. So I think that's very much, I think we agree on that very much.
And even if it does all go pear-shaped and humanity goes extinct, we will still have contributed to the collective consciousness of the cosmos.
I love that. Yes, that's very much my perspective. And to Gaia, you know, our mother, our planetary home, you know, Mother Earth, Gaia as a sentient being, because in this emergent new science, Our entire universe exists and evolves as a unified, fundamentally sentient and intelligent entity. So yes, we're contributing to its journey of evolution of our entire universe and our beloved home Gaia, regardless of whether humanity itself goes extinct or not.
Thank you. And we'll come back to the science just after this short break. Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community, learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. So, Jude, a question that I love to ask all of my guests is, if you were democratically elected queen of the world for a day, what would your first decree be and why?
I love that question, and I love that I'll never be in that position to have to do it.
Be a tough job.
Be a tough job. But somebody perhaps one day might. For me, I've seen the coming of the internet. And like Tim Berners-Lee, at the beginning of the internet, I was full of optimism for it. And I'm still optimistic of it. But the thing that happened right at the beginning, which I would have decreed not to happen, is the ability to go onto social media anonymously and therefore hide behind that anonymity, because it seems to me that that's unleashed a huge level of bad behaviour. And there's something about when we face someone and speak our name, those social boundaries, that civility that is the glue, really, of a civilised society can hold. But when we lose that glue, then, you know, we have an internet where so much runs rampant. So my decree was that anyone who goes onto the internet goes on with their own face and their own name, and certainly to do so on social media. I realise there's reasons why, perhaps not everywhere, but certainly on social media, because that's our forum. You know, that's the forum that the Greeks pioneered as a way to come together as a civitas, as citizens. So that's what I would decree.
Yes, that's taking me back to a memory of when I was living close to Silicon Valley at the time when Twitter first appeared. And somebody described it to me, the first time I ever heard of Twitter, someone described it as, yeah, it's really great. You get 140 characters and you can tell people what you're doing right now. I thought, well, that sounds really boring and pointless. So it actually seemed innocuous, but kind of fairly meaningless to me at the time. And I had no idea that it was going to become, on the one hand, an amazing way of sharing news and enforcing accountability and a lot of potentially positive uses, but also human beings being humans, also finding ways to use it as a tool for domination and bullying and meanness. And I've been on the receiving end of a little bit of that when one of my voyages went sideways early on. But, you know, a tiny smidge of what people like Hillary Clinton or Monica Lewinsky have faced in that domain. So I would be all in favour, and I would definitely vote you in for a second day for that.
Would I have to make a second decree, though? That's the point.
Well, I guess you would be allowed to honourably abdicate if you really preferred to, maybe establish a global council.
I like that. That is my second decree. That's exactly what I would do.
Cool. So I'd love to come back to science and spirituality, because I'm really fascinated by this. It feels to me like a couple of hundred years ago, science and spirituality headed off in diametrically opposite directions, that there was sort of this real division or dichotomy between the two. But it's like there's this Irish saying that you're so far east, you're west. So it sort of feels like they're meeting up around the back and they're sort of starting to flirt with each other again and maybe even like agree on a few things. You really straddle both of those worlds so beautifully, the science and the spirituality, with also a strong business background. But focusing for now on the science and spirituality, this must be an exciting time for you as there is this beautiful convergence happening.
It really is. But it seems to me that at this point, as we were saying earlier about breakdown and potential breakthrough, this convergence of science and spirituality, it seems to me can be a really important foundation and framework for a new narrative to support us through this time. Because I think, as you were saying earlier, you know, the breakdown aspect, you know, we tip into the old scientific paradigm, which is essentially meaningless and purposelessness. It doesn't offer any meaning and purpose to the existence of our universe. It's a universe of separation and materiality. We don't really have an innate part to play. And yet this new science, and I think what's really important, Roz, is it's based on evidence. It's not just a theoretical framework. It's based on evidence. And it's based on evidence across, you know, many, many different fields of research and literally across all scales of existence, from scales that are small compared to an atom, as an atom is to the entire universe. So this evidence has literally been coming forward only, I would say, in the last decade, the last few years. But what it's doing is it's coming together with not just compelling evidence, but the evidence is telling the same new story, the same new narrative. And it's turning the old science upside down because it's showing us, as I mentioned earlier, our universe exists and evolves as a unified entity. Everything is in relationship to everything else. Crucially, it embodies an evolutionary impulse from simplicity to ever greater complexity from the very beginning. It didn't begin in a big bang, which wasn't big and it wasn't a bang. It began very, very small, which the Big Bang does acknowledge, but not in a bang. It began incredibly ordered, exquisitely fine-tuned. As I say, this innate relationship of all of it already from the very beginning, like those Buddha babies that are being born. And ever since, as time's flowed and space has expanded, it's been able to embody ever more experience, evolution, and complexity. So this new narrative, this new science is a cosmology of consciousness, because it is showing us that everything is mind and consciousness, that we're microcosms of that. So it's actually offering us as that, it's offering a science of love, because for me, the opposite of love is fear. So love connects, fear divides. So in a sense, the old science was a cosmology of fear, a cosmology of scarcity, a cosmology of separation. And then the evidence of this new science is helping us wake up to remember we're inseparable. So it's innately a science of love, of relationship.
Yes, that really resonates. I absolutely love your work. And another... And I've got my copy of the Cosmic Hologram right here. And another author whose work I found really interesting recently is Don Hoffman and his book, The Case Against Reality. And he's coming at it from a sort of psychological and mathematical perspective, setting out to solve the hard problem of consciousness. Like, how does this blob of grey goo in our craniums give rise to consciousness? And he sort of flipped the question around and thought maybe we're coming at this from the wrong direction. And without going into it in too much detail, this idea of sort of nested consciousnesses, that when he created a mathematical equation for consciousness, when you multiply it up at every level, it still defines consciousness. So this really kind of, you know, combined with your work to rock my world, to see myself as like a colony of all of these little conscious cells, each doing their own thing with admittedly a fairly limited level of consciousness. And I'm no more aware of their consciousnesses as Gaia is of mine. But to me, it just then sort of made logical sense that Gaia has consciousness and the cosmos has consciousness. And that it does have this evolutionary impulse. I think there's this rather anthropocentric arrogance that, like, we're the only thing around here that's evolving. But I love it that it seems like every time the scientists come out with new research into forests or into, say, ocean creatures, they're like, oh, it's more intelligent than we thought it was. So
I agree. I find that very annoying.
Yes. So I don't know if it's that we are just getting better at discovering that intelligence, or maybe being a little bit less dogmatic about what intelligence looks like. It doesn't have to look like having a brain. You know, a tree doesn't have a grey blobby thing like we do, but it still has intelligence. Or whether it is that the consciousness of all of these aspects of creation are actually evolving at the same time as we are in sophistication and connectedness.
I love that. I really like Don Hoffman. He and I had a chance to have a really good conversation about all of this a couple of years ago in California. And the thing I would say is, I heartily agree. I mean, the so-called hard question of consciousness is exactly that. David Chambers actually came up with it. You know, how does an immaterial mind arise from a material brain? And for me too, it's the wrong question, because there is no separation of materiality, immateriality. It's just that the appearance of materiality is informationally imbued as mind is. You know, literally, when we see that mind and consciousness are what we and the whole world are, then what we're seeing is a differentiation into the appearance of a physical body. But the appearance of the physical body is still ultimately consciousness expressed as meaningful information, expressed as energy, matter, and space-time. So once we get past all of that sort of separating out and realize that it's a differentiation, not a separation, we're making headway. The other thing that I would say, and Don is an absolutely wonderful, wonderful researcher, and he's coming from human perspective. So he is coming from the anthropocentric perspective of human consciousness, and has done a great job in that. Where I'm coming from really is universal consciousness, which really isn't that bothered whether humanity's here or not. As my mum used to say, the universe has got bigger fish to fry.
That phrase about fish to fry was in my head as well, so I love it that you said that, yes.
But, you know, that's not to say because we're part of a universe that exists and evolves as a unified entity that exists to evolve, we have innate meaning and purpose with us being here. We're here at the culmination of 13.8 billion years of that inexorable evolutionary impulse from simplicity to complexity. We're standing on the bow wave of our universe's possibility for more and, you know, for individuated self-awareness. And we're its microcosmic co-creators. But what I tend to look at is from the universe and the cosmos in, and then human consciousness, and Don looks the other way around, because that's his speciality, and for me it's and it's both. But, you know, one of the things I think science is helpful for us, whether it's the old paradigm or the expansion now into the new paradigm, which brings consciousness at the very heart and all pervasiveness of this emergent new science, is that it's a way of us exploring beyond our human perception, the grandeur of the universe.
So help me out here, Jude, because I feel, you know, I read these books and I listen to these podcasts, and I feel like cognitively I get this idea of, you know, the whole worldview of unity consciousness. We're all connected, this story of interbeing versus the story of separation, as Charles Eisenstein would put it. But I still feel like there are some people who really know this, like with a deep knowing that I, at the moment, can only aspire to. And I'm wondering, without the help of psychedelics, like, how can the average person arrive at this really embodied understanding that we are all one, that we are all connected? Can you help me?
I can do my best from my own experience and perspective, because I don't feel any of us can do anything other than from that perspective. When I wrote The Cosmic Hologram, I saw it as the first of a trilogy of books. And what came through is that is not just to understand what I call unity awareness, which is the knowing, which is the cosmic hologram, but crucially, vitally, to experience it, as you're saying, and embody it. And for me, what that is what makes your heart sing? What makes your heart sing? What is it that when you experience it, you just feel love? And it may be looking in the eyes of that Buddhic baby. It may be a sunrise. It may be being with a tree and in a forest, perhaps, and realizing, as you were saying earlier, that forests have mother trees, as Suzanne Simard has been such a wonderful pioneer in revealing to us. Forests have mother trees that look after the other trees. And in writing Gaia, her story, my new book, I've been in awe. I've been in awe of this interrelated web of life that the indigenous traditions have always maintained and spiritual seekers have always sought. So I would reflect that back to you and ask the question, and of everyone, if you have something that makes your heart sing, go with it, live it, be it, because that is the way in. That is the way into remembering, literally remembering that relationship, that love, that interrelationship.
That's so actionable. Thank you very much for that, Jude. Yeah, I suppose with that perspective, I would say that my practice is my morning walk in Standish Woods, which just above my house. And nothing makes me happier than looking up at the sunlight filtering through the green leaves and just thinking of all that miraculous photosynthesis stuff going on in there. And also feeling really in the wood. There's like this big green tent that I feel somehow enfolded in, because all of the leaves are angled outwards and I'm in there amongst the trunks. And there's something very cradling and reassuring about that, that does bring me great joy.
Absolutely. I mean, the Japanese people call it forest bathing. And it's that immersion in the forest. Of course, there's as much going on under the ground as there is going above the ground.
Yeah, and it's so cool to think about that too. Yes, the yin, underground, mysterious stuff that with our human tendency to think that what we see is all there is, we tend to forget about the other half of the reality of a forest.
Exactly. And when we say we believe in what we see, well, actually, we take advantage of the technologies that are all available to us because of microwaves and radio waves and electromagnetic fields that we can't see. And yet we become so used to them that we just take them for granted. And yet when we're sort of told of all these other realms and dimensions that we can't see, somehow that's less familiar to us. But one of the things that I would also invite, because I do feel this is another way into this great adventure of remembering and experiencing unity awareness, is intuition. Intuition is our superpower. It really is. If we listen to our intuition and don't discount it, but realize that it's that resonance that connects us, you know, with everything else around us and beyond our horizon, the more we actually listen and follow and hear our intuition, that again helps us to take this great journey of what I call homecoming to who we really are.
And again, I was kind of a real late bloomer when it came to hearing my intuition. I heard it described really beautifully that the ego mind, I'm not going to blow out anybody's eardrums by shouting, but you know, the ego mind tends to be really, really loud, so we can't ignore it. While the voice of intuition is like this quiet little whisper that we have to really listen for and pay attention to and give gratitude to when we do connect with it, that it comes back again.
Absolutely. There's a real beautiful cycle of love, joy and gratitude. And when we are in that cycle, again, that's another daily, you know, to be grateful for however little we have. You know, whatever in a day, it can be that hour in the forest in the morning. It can be a beautiful boiled egg for breakfast. It can be the fact that ABBA is reuniting. Yay!
Yay!
Oh, yay! I mean, this is my happy place because ABBA are reuniting and they're going on a holographic tour.
Yes! How perfect is that? Talk about worlds colliding.
I love it. It's even too grating. It's wonderful. So, yeah, and the other superpower, if we hear and listen, is paying attention to synchronicities, because I do find that synchronicities and, you know, hearing and listening to our intuition are companions. They're wonderful traveling companions.
I love that. Yes, The Celestine Prophecy was a life-changing book for me when I read it 20 years ago. And it's like, okay. So yeah, coincidences might not be. And there is this kind of sense of, it seems to me that your view of the world is magical, not in a kind of delusional sense, but magical as in just really noticing, paying attention to, nurturing that beauty and harmony of everything. Is that how it feels to be Jude Currivan?
Yes. For 95% of the time. And the other 5%, I still slip back into the, you know, into the, what's going on in the world? But yes, it's like daily magic. And what I really do, and again, this is where gratitude comes in, and I'm sure it does for you, is to be grateful for being able to appreciate those synchronicities and those way showers. To be grateful for the really beautiful everyday miracles. You know, it's back to the ordinariness and the extraordinariness. It's experiencing the extraordinariness in the ordinariness and being grateful for the ordinariness in the extraordinariness.
So beautifully said. Thank you. We're just going to take a short break now, and then I will come back with another one of my traditional questions. Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community, learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. So, Jude, in these strange COVID times when you and I are speaking right now, some people have been exploring some new things, which may or may not be relevant to this question. When was the last time that you did something for the first time, and what was it?
That's a really interesting question for me, because I've lived long enough that I've done many, many, many things for the first time, but most of them quite some time ago. So I really was feeling into this. And my husband and I have a reasonable sized garden, and we had grown vegetables for 15 years. But Tony got a rush of blood to the head and decided that we had enough space for more raised beds to grow more vegetables. So this year we love growing our own vegetables. There's something wonderful about digging for dinner, and there's something wonderful about seeing the tiny little seeds. We, you know, the podcast called Seeds of Change or Seeds for Change. And isn't it amazing to sort of plant a seed, these tiny seeds, and then you get this incredible abundance of produce. So we grew vegetables that we had no idea how to cook once they grow. So it was really a magical mystery tour. So things like kohlrabi and pak choy and beautiful, wonderful vegetables with these exotic names that are actually very easy to grow. And they've invited us on adventure this year. So it's been lovely. Really enjoyed it.
How wonderful. I'm glad that you've had a better harvest than I did. I moved house 6 months ago and tried to establish a vegetable garden. But I have a lot of dry stone walls holding up the terraces in my very steep garden that are an absolute haven for slugs and snails, which ate almost everything apart from the beetroot. And my last hope is at the moment my butternut squash is growing like a triffid, and it looks like it is developing some squashes on it. So I'm just really praying that slugs don't like butternut.
So we had three raised beds of beautiful brassicas, and we thought we were doing really well. And then we had a brassica massacre.
I'm sorry to hear that. I have a lovely permaculture teacher who said that if we get frustrated with certain creatures eating the food that we'd hoped for ourselves, then it's not nature that we need to change, it's our attitude.
Totally agree.
So, moving on from vegetables and back to sowing the seeds of change and saving the world or whatever. I would love to hear more from you about your vision for the future. You have such a beautiful positivity about you and a real, not a utopian, dreamy, fluffy optimism, but actually a very, it seems to me, grounded optimism, that there really are signs of hope for the future. So when you picture the world, let's pick a random year and say, oh, well, I'm going to pick what would be my 100th birthday, 2067. What do you think our future might be looking like, if you can think that, imagine that far ahead?
What a great question. I guess I'd like to just take a step back, if I might, and then go forward. I mean, I think one of the great good fortunes of my whole life was to have my mum, because she taught me, I think, everything really about life. And I was the daughter and granddaughter of coal miners. And that's a very hard life. And my dad passed over when I was 10 years old. So my mum brought myself, my younger brother, up as a single mum in the 60s. And, you know, none of our family had ever gone to university. We had very little money. I worked from the age of 14, Friday nights and Saturdays. And she lived this optimistic life that didn't mean it was an easy life, but she just had this innate optimism. And she came from a long line of strong women, you know, that had had to find optimism to carry on.
That's such a beautiful reminder that, yeah, optimism has very little to do with circumstances. It's a choice, isn't it?
And it's not a fluffy choice. And I don't think hope is a fluffy choice, you know, and you're saying about not being naive. And I do feel very grounded. I can see futures, you know, catastrophic, cataclysmic. And yet I'll still show up and hopefully get out of the way of the possibility of better futures in whatever way. So for me, it's always comes back to what choice am I making today? And what can I do to help that choice link up and lift up with others in coalitions of the willing, with similar choices to do, to show up, get out of the way, do the best we can. And the other thing that I've learned over many, many years is not to see that as some sort of mission or some sort of burden, but to really just see it as is my choice in being here and being human and serving something that's greater than all of us. And so when from that perspective and you know, helping and hoping to bring forward this new perspective, this new whole world view, where science converges and integrates with spirituality and consciousness and reveals a meaningful, purposeful, evolving universe of which we have parts to play. If I can share that with others and they get that, not just here in our heads, but experience it in our hearts and embody it in our purpose, then 2067 can actually be a world that is truly transformed, because, you know, our collective dis-ease is our fragmented perspective of the nature of reality. It's a more fundamental dis-ease than any pandemic. So if we can heal that dis-ease, which we now have the evidence to show, you know, is based on a wrong perspective of reality, and instead come from a lived science and experience of love, then we can literally come together to transform how we are with ourselves, with each other, and above all with our planetary home, Gaia. I really think she's rooting for us, but my goodness me, bless her as any mum, she's getting to that point. You know, we're appalling teenagers at this moment. But just as our teenagers, my two teenagers were never appalling, but they've grown into wonderful adults. Maybe now we can grow up and wake up to remember we're inseparable. And that is what I hope and see for 2067 and before, way, way before that.
Amen, sister. Beautifully said. And I think your father would be or is very proud of you wherever he is now, looking at what you've achieved. How amazing. One of your superpowers is bringing together those coalitions of the willing through these groups like Whole World View. And I love that statement of the Hopi elders about the era of the lone wolf is over. You know, this is our time to find our tribe, find our communities, and work together in such a way that the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts. So I hope that gathers strength so that in 2067, they're looking back and going, gosh, those poor folks in the 2020s, like how it must have been so hard living life in that isolated, individualistic kind of a way. Isn't it great the way that we live now where we really understand that we're all in this together?
Absolutely. What a wonderful vision. And, you know, the Indigenous folks that I've lived with over the years, that's how they already live. That's how they've always lived when they've been, you know, allowed to be their own communities. And I talk a lot about, you know, we talk a lot about now more and more about unity in diversity. But I'd like to sort of expand that, to go beyond unity in diversity, to go even beyond unity in inclusion, to unity in belonging, to remember that we belong here. We belong to each other. We belong to our planetary home. We belong to our entire universe. We are loved. We are supported. And if we can wake up to that knowingness, we literally can change the world and heal ourselves and heal our relationship with the whole world.
That belonging is such a beautiful word, because isn't that what we all deeply want, is that sense of psychological safety, you know, of being at home, of being loved, of being accepted exactly as we are, warts and all. And it feels like at the moment we seek that sense of belonging in some fairly confused ways. When you look at some of the tribalism that goes on, it is that very natural yearning for a sense of belonging. But when the belonging depends on the othering of another group in order to feel that you belong to this group.
And that's why it's so crucial that we begin from the perspective of unity, this wholeness, this understanding that we are all profoundly, fundamentally, not just, you know, interconnected, but we are all microcosms of the whole. Because you're right, if we go from the old paradigm of separation, there's an innate longing to belong in each and every one of us, as you say. So if we're coming from that old paradigm of separation and scarcity, then we'll grasp a belonging, which can be very partisan, it can be very dysfunctional, it can be very, you know, culturally, ethnically, gender, you know, separate. So it's in a way that there's a journey from where we are to wake up to remember unity, and that can then come into unity in diversity. It can then come into more of an inclusion, and then it can come into belonging. But that, for me, that belonging is this beautiful vision where, as you say, we're here because we belong. Nobody had to invite us in. Nobody had to send us a nice invite. We're here because we belong, and we belong as authentically who we are, you know, within an entire human family, within an entire planetary family, within an entire universal family.
That's so beautiful. It reminds me of that line from Desiderata, which is about, I'm not going to get this word perfect, but you are a child of the universe. Like, you have a right to be here. And that's the truth of it when we ignore all of the marketing messages and the propaganda and the fear-based messaging that we are exposed to on a daily basis that tries to take us out of our home and out of our sense of belonging.
And that is itself based on the old paradigm of separation, which is fundamentally wrong. So, you know, as we, you know, and you say about coalitions of the willing and linking up and lifting up as I do, it's really bringing this message into education, into transformational leadership, to our relationship with Gaia, to profound, profound ecological basis, into healthcare and into the media. You know, not to be fluffy, but when you come from this place, we can tell stories. You know, this new science, this new narrative of unified integral reality, we can tell new stories and we can sing new songs together. And this is so wonderfully exciting because these new songs, goodness knows where they can carry us in terms of our, you know, evolutionary consciousness as part of the evolutionary impulse of the whole universe.
Thank you, Jude. Just before I go to my final question, which is actually to ask you to ask a question, is there anything else that I feel like you've shared so much beautiful wisdom in this? Was there anything that you're burning to tell me that I haven't asked you about? Or would we be here for the rest of the week?
Will we be here for the rest of the day? I would like to ask you, but not the final question, but the thing that you embody is this sense of indomitable willingness to go the extra mile, literally, whatever you do, whatever you do. And I'd love you to share with me, where do you find the resources within yourself to do that?
Well, the glib answer is that with the ocean rowing, it's logistically very, very difficult to quit in the middle of an ocean. Like, you can't catch the bus home. Like, you're pretty much stuck there unless you're really going to swallow all your pride and call for a big, embarrassing rescue. So I think for the first ocean, that was very fortunate, because there were many, many days when I really felt that I had bitten off so much more than I could chew. I was literally so far out of my depth. But the more serious answer is I had massive motivation, and I think you'll relate to this. I'd had this environmental awakening. I was desperate to raise awareness of our ecological crisis. And I had sat in this agony of feeling the ticking of the clock with the planet in my imagination just getting worse, more polluted, more exploited with every passing day and hour while I sat around trying to figure out what I was going to do to help. And then this was kind of my voice of God moment, was receiving this calling. The ingredients were there. I knew about this strange and masochistic activity of ocean rowing. I knew I wanted some kind of a physical adventure. I was already blogging, so I knew that I could use the internet to get across whatever message. But it really was when I wasn't even thinking about it. I was on a long drive and this crazy idea had me. It just arrived fully formed. And in my heart, I knew immediately that it was what I'd been looking for. Even during the preparations, there were a lot of wobbly moments, as you can imagine, where I was running out of money or running out of confidence. I just kept running. It was sort of like Wile E. Coyote. You know, he only gets into trouble as he's run off the cliff over the canyon. He's only in trouble when he looks down and realises there's only thin air beneath him. So I thought, if I just don't look down, if I just keep running, then I'll be okay. It was that kind of dynamic going on, because I was so motivated by the environmental mission, by having felt called to do this, and also knowing that I believe all of us, I knew that I was capable more than I'd allowed myself to be. I knew that I had, or I suspected, I can't say that I knew, I suspected I might have some latent strengths and resources of courage that had never been tapped into, because we don't know they're there until we need them.
Absolutely. Thank you, thank you, thank you for that, because that's just, I think, for everyone listening, is this call, isn't it? Whatever the call is, a whole world view, you talk about acting local, and an ocean is not local, but, you know, it is act local, act what comes to you, respond to it, and do it. And it could be something that seems incredibly tiny, but we never know, because life is non-linear, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, you answered that call, and you showed up, and you kept on keeping on. And it just seems to me that is our opportunity. Wherever we're called, however we're called, each of us is at some point. And we can link up and lift up together and co-create something that's greater than the sum of all those parts. So thank you. Thank you for all you do. And thank you for sharing that so openly.
Well, I do believe that... To use a good maritime metaphor, I do believe that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that when one of us actually answers that call and sets out on our own individual hero's journey, and I'm not for a moment calling myself a hero. I felt absolutely anything but heroic when I was in that little rowboat. And also, I have had people say to me, how on earth does rowing across oceans help resolve the ecological crisis? And I suppose I just have to say, well, I don't know, but I trusted that the universe knew when she called me to do this. Actually, it was a genius plan in ways that I could not appreciate or even begin to imagine at the time. That it just kind of worked. But to the logical mind, the ego mind, it made no sense at all. But to the heart mind, there was this knowing that this was it. This was the answer to my prayer for something to do to contribute to the greater good.
Exactly. And, you know, our mind, our ego mind, not our higher mind, but our ego mind is very good at separating, or apparently separating, but it's our hearts that bring everything together. So to actually say thank you to our ego minds, because it's really great at analysing and all the rest of it. So it really is that heart-mind integration. But hearing that call, like you're saying, for me has always been a call of the heart. The heart calls. And then the head can come in and say, yeah, well, we need to do X, Y, Z to make this call a reality. Yes. But it's the heart that's in the driving seat. It's the heart that's responding to the call.
Yeah, the head's a very good executive director and risk manager, because, you know, its job is to keep us safe. And I think I've become much better at recognising the mind doing its job to protect me from embarrassment, humiliation, death. Maybe. But distinguishing between it doing its job there and knowing that the difference between, I suppose, a head, well, not sure about this, and an intuitive, not sure about this. And it's kind of a different feeling. Yes.
Yeah, I think the journey of discovery is how to differentiate and how to balance and how to sort of reconcile those.
Jude, this has been an absolutely heartwarming, uplifting, optimistic, beautiful, energising conversation. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, Ross, thank you for inviting me, and bravo, brava on everything you're doing. Bless you.
I enjoyed every single moment of that conversation, and I hope you did too. What I really took away from it is this perspective that we live in a participatory universe, that our apparently individual consciousness is actually a fractal of the one cosmic mind, so we're connected in many ways that we can't see. And it seems that there's growing evidence, both from science and from anecdotal evidence, that even though they're invisible, these connections are very, very real. We're now in this volatile state between the old materialistic worldview and the new paradigm in which consciousness is key, maybe even the ground out of which all else arises.